Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Right, we've got to Pierce, who at the time of recording has come fifth in the best ever Bond actor.
Is that right? Fifth?
It is, yeah.
Lord.
I mean, Lazenby was sixth, but it's not really a fair
Well, no, that's just one movie.
It's old-fashioned and timing, isn't it? I mean, Timothy Dalton, who, as we all know, we love, he would have probably come fifth if we'd done this 10 years ago. It's just timing, and I think there's been enough of a gap now for people who didn't think Dalton was right at the time to reassess him, and they're suddenly realising, actually, he's brilliant. And I think the same will happen with Pierce, especially his performance in his first couple of films. And to be honest, even in his last film, which is my lowest-ranked Bond film, I think he's not the bad part of it.
No.
By any means.
And if you do this in 10 years' time, Craig will come fifth, so it's all good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Full circle, job done, thank you.
Sorry, listeners switching off. Rather than...
Oh, no, they've gone off on a tangent. Hours, quick, let's go. Yeah. Sure, there's something on Radio 4.
Well, they better wait a bit longer because we won't be on to Daniel Craig just yet. So, Pierce Brosnan, obviously, you know, one of the most famous stunts in the entire series is how we're introduced to him, and this is... You know, it's not one of those where it's so obvious, I don't want to say it's one of the best stunts. Sorry, it is, isn't it? It really is.
It's a remarkable gag on the basis of, well, firstly, it being done for real, obviously. I mean, Wayne Michaels is actually stood there and is diving off that dam for real. They brought in, because this had never been done again. You know, it's the Bond films and doing stuff for real and doing new stuff that's never been touched, but pushing the boundaries. It had never been done. On the strength of that, they needed to find out, how the hell do you do it? They write it into the script, and obviously somebody had done some theory behind it, but, you know, you say, well, how do we do this? Well, they get in contact with the Oxford Bungee Company, who are the people who are responsible for the technicalities of the rope and everything else to go along with it, and the tension and the science behind the whole thing. And they bring in a huge crane, which will support the length of the whole thing. And then they tell Wayne that he's got, you know, you've got to not only hold your position on the way down and make it look like the absolute greatest swan dive ever, but you've also at the bottom of the fall, when the tension kicks in, you've got to do a bit of acting. Now, acting, and Wayne's acted before. He's played various characters in lots of television and film. They do stuff to camera all the time. They are actors. They are trained actors. And certainly around the time when this was being made, you still needed an equity card in order to appear on screen. Therefore, you would have to prove that you could act. And Wayne can act. But when you're having to act at 175 miles an hour, whilst firstly having all of the wind taken out of your sails, and then reaching into your jacket, pulling out a gun and then holding it in the aforementioned pose before disappearing just out of sight from behind a rock. That is a seriously classy piece of work. So it's very, very good that, they remember that shot on top as he dives off, the breath and then off he goes.
Like this, doesn't it?
It does, well, you know, and that's why he was such an excellent double, because he really did look with that. He'd got a blessed with great hair, Wayne.
Yes,
and Pierce, to be fair, and on the strength of that, the two of them were like peas in a pod. So on the strength of that, he stands there and he gives that position and does the dive. That other camera, when it kicks in and you watch him go down, you can see him fighting. Now, he's got that updraft, and, of course, he's falling at 100-plus miles an hour, and the wind from underneath is coming up, and he's being buffeted. And if you watch it closely, you watch his arms, and they're moving from side to side because he's having to physically balance himself. Being a high-fall guy, which Wayne had done plenty of, you have to be aware of your body position in the air. You need to know where you are all the time so that should you need to adjust, am I in the right place to be able to hit the landing bed at this point? Do I need to move slightly? I need to propel my body this way. So you have to adjust as you're moving. So he's doing an awful lot. It's not just jumping off and hoping that the rope will hold. He's got to do a whole lot of stuff psychologically to make sure that physically his body's in the right position. And then to remember, and we talked about Rick Sylvester jumping off the rock in For Your Eyes Only, forgetting that he, you know, was supposed to be unconscious and let out this huge, this scream to himself. Well, you know, Wayne has to try and remember, right, I've done all of this. Now I've got to get the gun out, hold that position, and then I can let, and then I'll get taken back up again. But it's a fascinating moment. And to start a movie with it as well, yeah. You know, we found recently those deleted scenes of the early clip of that. There's moments where Bond, just before he rushes out onto the dam, people go, well, why is the gate opening? And of course, there was scene shot of him being inside the little control hut there, talking or distracting the two guys that were in there and pushing the button so the gate would open so he could run across. But it doesn't make, luckily they cut it out because it doesn't really make any sense to the sequence anyway.
It's interesting because I think what we probably get is none of Pierce Brosnan. So Pierce Brosnan's first minute or two of being Bond on screen is actually Wayne, I assume. I assume all those shots are him.
Yeah. All of those shots are Wayne. The first, you see a shot of his eyes when he's firing the laser, the close-up of his eyes, and then his first real shot of him and his dialogue is upside down in the toilet.
Yeah. I suppose you could technically say the first shot of Timothy Dalton's Bond is a stuntman as he jumps out of the plane, but you're not quite clear which one is him anyway.
No, that's right.
But with Pierce, it's just funny that it's very specific. You've got very quite extensive shots of the introduction of this new Bond we've all been waiting for. It's not actually Pierce Brosnan. Yeah.
Definitely not him, no.
Yeah.
Well, they did it with Lazenby, didn't they? As well, yeah. And Tim to an extent.
Yeah, to an extent. Lazenby with the eyes and the lighting of the cigarette and all of that sort of stuff, which was nice.
And that shot that Martin Campbell does, which I just adore, which comes up over the back of Wayne, and it gives you as a viewer a real feeling of height and how scary that is to do, and the way he does it in one shot and Wayne jumps off it. That's actually a shot he uses in No Escape, Campbell, that exact same shot. He does it at the end of a chase sequence where I've not seen it for 20-odd years, but Ray Liotta's character, I think he reaches the end of a cliff and the camera's following him. And as he sort of stops to stop himself tumbling over, the camera swoops up and over him and literally does that exact same shot.
Right.
And obviously Martin Campbell thought, well, that was effective. I might just reuse that.
Is that his signature move then, the way that...
Yeah, because I think he used it again in that film, which I always call Cliffhanger, but it's not Cliffhanger, it's the other one in the snow.
Vertical Limit.
I think he uses it again in Vertical Limit as well.
Spielberg has the sunset moment, if you're a fan of Spielberg pictures. There's always a sunset or people in front of a sunset in his pictures. That's his signature moment.
And Spielberg also, although I think Hitchcock had used it once before, but he did a lot with that pullback and zoom shot, obviously, which he uses in Jaws, and then he uses in lots of his films, and then it appeared everywhere in cinema after that.
Well, I mean, that cost you...
I'm just going through Hook now in my head, trying to think of Spielberg's signature sunset.
There's got to be one in there somewhere.
And the mooning. It's when Tinkerbell comes at the end, and he's, I believe in fairies. And then she goes,
that's quality memory, John. Well done.
It's been verified, so it's correct.
We've managed to drag that. Now, hopefully there's people now going to go, really? And they'll rush off and go and check out Spielberg stuff as well. But I guarantee there is one in every one of his movies, even from Duel onwards. And his TV stuff as well. That's his thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that opening bungee sequence, phenomenal, yeah, and a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful way to start a Bond film. And of course,
I remember the second time I watched it for my, I think it was my 12th or 13th birthday with my friends. But then I loved it so much. I know.
I'm so old.
Well, no, some people will think I'm very old then, but I then watched it again with Math, my brother, and we were a bit late. Because I think he wasn't 12, we tried to snuck him in. And we walked in. As we were walking in, he was literally falling down.
Ah.
And it was deathly silent.
Quiet moment.
So good. But the wind, the noise of the wind,
yeah.
It's just. Oh, again at the cinema, it's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it was the Spy Who Loved Me trick, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Cut all the sound and have natural sound, and that's the way to do it. So I do think Campbell's a great director. I'd love him to do another Bond film. Yeah,
sometimes nothing is better than something, and that's exactly what he's done there. He's taken the... You don't want to detract from that moment on screen, that visual, by having da-da-da-da over the top of it. You know, you just want to...
Especially as Eric Serra was doing the music. I mean, goodness. We could have got there.
I won't have anything said against Eric Serra's score. I'm a big fan of his.
Do you know, I've actually, it's grown on me in recent years. I hate, obviously, the song at the end of the film. It's just so bad, it's hilarious.
That's his,
the rest of the score, I find it, in places, I think it's great. In other bits that I thought were a bit quirky at the time, like, they've grown on me, they're fine. But you're a big fan, are you? But I'm looking at both John's novels.
I've always enjoyed it. Because I liked his stuff that he did with Big Blue, the Jean-Luc Besson stuff, I was always a big fan of. And what he did really, I think, was to do something completely different. Who does the Bond theme on timpani? You know, that's brilliant. Why haven't that happened?
It was good. It is good.
Great idea.
Yeah.
Lots of lovely little moments with the electronics and all the other bits and pieces that really fits that kind of... I couldn't hear anybody else's music on it now. If you tried to put something else on, it wouldn't work. You know?
I really like it in many ways. And I certainly don't think it's the worst score. I really don't. And what it will always be, it's different. You know, it's different. I think... What I find interesting with it is that it's usually always just tarred with the electronic brush. And I don't think that's fair. There's some absolutely gorgeous string moments in it. Like, you know,
Our Lady of Smolensk and tracks of that nature, which really do utilise the theme that runs through the picture, gives it that sort of suspense feel as well. I think it's very clever. It's very clever.
I think it's because that electric music is so obvious in that scene with the Ferrari with on the top. It is slightly odd in that scene. That's probably, I'm trying to remember, and I've seen this film probably as many as 30 times. That's probably the only time it really actually has a lot of electronic music, but it's so obvious that it's what you kind of remember. I did, just to drop in, this is long before people had phones with cameras and all that stuff. Obviously, I was working in TV at that time, so I was lucky to have access to edit suite stuff that most people at home couldn't dream of. And I did do a re-edit of the GoldenEye music just to insert the Bond theme at the end of the pre-credit sequence, you know, when the base explodes and the plane flies. I had the theme tune come in there, just, you know, and it would just end as Tina Turner, the first beats of GoldenEye came in.
Lovely.
And I swear it was an improvement, but I know that Eric was told to keep the Bond music out of it because they were worried it was something that was seen as old hat. And then you get Tomorrow Never Dies, and it's literally in every scene.
Well, that's it. And then there's an interview with John Altman, who of course was brought in to pretty much go, John, do us a favor, can you clean this mess up? Was the instruction that he was given. And, you know, he's a tank chase, you know, and a few little other bits of tiny orchestration here and there. But he didn't do anything drastically out of. I've watched that tank chase with the original tank chase music on it, and I think it's quite fun, to be fair. You know, once you get into that Serra thing, you go, hang on, what's this? This is a weird thing. Where's he come up with this? Where's all the electronics? Oh, and then you realise afterwards, let's get rid of that. Let's not use that. Let's put this instead. But I think it's great fun. I've always been a big fan of it. But, I mean, GoldenEye at the time, was it just enormous? You know, we'd waited so long for it. The teaser trailer, without question, is the finest piece of teaser trailering I've ever seen in my life. Somebody showed me today that it's on YouTube, remastered. It looks absolutely spectacular. I watched it again this morning.
The teaser trailer is unbelievable, and it's what every teaser trailer should do. It brings all the action without telling you anything of the story. It's superb.
No, and that's exactly what used to happen with the Roger films. Roger used to come up in the gun barrel at the front, bang, and then walk towards camera, and then the trailer would kick in. Well, that's exactly what Pierce does. Only on this occasion, he says, well, you were expecting somebody else, which is a fabulous line.
You were expecting someone else?
I have to caveat it with the theatrical trailer is horrendous. Have you ever seen the theatrical trailer?
I don't think I have. No.
Right, the theatrical trailer goes...
It's got a voiceover that says, it was a world where no
one mattered. But it says, this time, Bond has met his match, 006 Alec Trevelyan. And it's the whole plot away in the theatrical trailer.
What do you mean? Because I didn't know that when I watched it.
No, I don't think I saw that trailer. I mean, I saw, they ran a lot, because I was 95, I was 19 then, because I am really old. And they ran the trailers a lot on TV, but they were obviously on TV because they're expensive. They were short ones, so you didn't get that. And they were great. They were probably somewhere between the teaser and a bit more of a theatrical trailer, so you got a little bit more. But they were just brilliant. They were just that high-paced trailers with no voiceover. They were just fast cut. They were absolutely brilliant trailers. Yeah, that theatrical trailer sounds terrible. I wonder if that was more for America, because they sometimes like things spelt out a little bit more.
Yeah. I find it's a lot, evidently.
Even in that pre-title sequence, you think, oh, well, that's amazing. But then you've got the motorcycle driving off the cliff, haven't you?
Well,
I know mid-air bit's CGI, but the actual stunt's another one.
Well, I mean, all of it's done practically to a point.
Yeah.
Firstly, I mean, with the rest of the sequence itself, I mean, obviously Wayne doubles Pierce throughout that entire sequence. Jim Dowdle, of course, who you've had on your show before, haven't you? I think Jim Dowdle. I mean, I had Jim on there. Well, of course, he's sat on the toilet reading the paper while Wayne comes down. Of course, Jim is the guy who arranged the whole tank check, because he's the military man. So he knew people of St. Petersburg. So, well, yeah, you can use the tank, but you can't use those tracks. So he then had to go off and source Tiger tracks, I think, or Sherman tanks or something of that nature, which are in rubber, so they could be used in order to let Gary throw the tank about the street. So that's him in there. Gary Powell, of course, is in there with a whole bunch of other people. And it's a very small stunt team. Paul Heaswin, I think, kills himself twice. You know, there's a whole number of series where he shoots himself at the top of the stairs, falls down the stairs, off the balcony, and then falls down the stairs again. And then he's there at the back of the shot as well. So it's a very, very small team. But yeah, the motorcycle scene is split into a number of sections. Firstly, at Leavesden itself. So you've got that whole chase sequence where Bond is running after the plane. He then gets to the plane, has a fight with the stunt guy who's the pilot, which is Paul Herbert. And then Paul Herbert is again... Then the motorcyclist, they fall out of the plane and hit the motorcyclist, which is him. So he knocks himself off his own bike, accordingly to that. And then Eddie Kidd takes over riding the motorcycle away to the cardboard mountains in the distance. And then it goes to a location shot of Mal Zuit Nui, who's the guy who jumps the motorcycle over the cliff chasing the plane. And then there's a separate shot of BJ Worth leaping from a plane and physically being behind the aircraft, and then they have a CG shot of Pierce, or a studio-based shot, but nevertheless, of Pierce getting into the plane. So all of them done practically to a point to create that one moment. And still now, when the plane disappears out of sight and then reappears again, and I get the little hairs on the back of my neck still, and I think it's just fantastic. It's a really, really fabulous sequence.
Yeah.
So a great deal of work.
The plane goes,
oh, I see. In your edit, that whole moment, and then I say just the first couple of notes of the Tina track as the plane flies over. It's really fantastic. And that's just in the first few minutes. You think, what on earth can they throw at us after that? You know, you've had the whole nine yards in that first few moments, but it's spectacular.
I mean, we're just pausing for breath on the
pausing floor. For breath.
That's just extraordinary.
That
opening sequence, I think, in a nutshell, actually, to an extent, sums up some of the brilliance of GoldenEye, because that film was made for roughly half the budget that True Lies was made for, and they were all at the time saying, "Oh, you know, True Lies is outdone Bond. Can Bond match it?" And then it had this budget that was about half.
Yeah,
and yet with the incredible work of the stunt team and Derek Meddings with his special effects.
Yeah,
I think they made this film look like it was a hugely budgeted film, and budget was about a fifth of what the Daniel Craig film were recently. And I just think they showed, you know, if you've got a good script, you don't keep changing the script; you stick with it. You get brilliant people.
There had been, you know, there's a format. There's something that the audiences flock back to time and time again, because it's safe ground They know what they like. They want to go into the cinema and have that same adrenaline rush that they normally get from a Bond film. And plus the fact they'd had a number of years off after License to Kill to sort of regroup and rework an idea and come up with something. Again, I think not taking anything away from Bob Simmons or Martin Grace, George Leitch or Paul Weston, but Simon Crane, again, had learnt from all of those, had worked for a couple of them on occasion, and had got to the stage where he could, as with all coordinators and with any actor, really, if the performance is good, it's because you've nicked something from that performance there and you've taken something from that performance there and then you've put it together and you've made it your own. And that's exactly what Simon Crane has done, because he's taken a little bit of Bob Simmons and he's taken a little bit of Martin Grace and George Leitch and he's taken a bit of Paul Weston, who he had worked for before. Of course, he was the Bond double on the previous two the Timothy Daltons, you know, working under Paul Weston. So he's very familiar with the way that Paul works. And he's taken a bit of that, a bit of this. He said, right, this is what I think we can do with this. Let's try and do this for real. Let's not do this. Let's maybe try this from this angle. This is a better way to shoot it from over here. And of course, on the strength of Goldeneye, Simon Crane became golden. You know, he was gold dust. Everything he touched turned to gold. Titanic. After, you know, he got the coordinating job on Titanic. Titanic was huge, and the amount of action that was required on Titanic was phenomenal. Vertical Limit, we talked about that earlier on, that he was taken by Campbell out to New Zealand. Let's go and do that. So all of these movies suddenly started arriving in his lap purely on the basis of the work that he's put in this particular movie. So it is a game-changing moment, without question.
I mean, the next bit in the film, I suppose, there are various action scenes, but the tank chase you've mentioned, that's not necessarily stunts. It's more, you know, vehicles, isn't it, crashing into each other. But there's still a lot of stuntmen involved.
Oh, well, I mean, that whole set. I mean, Leavesden.
Yeah, filming the entire thing.
Leavesden, as we know it now, of course, Leavesden is the home of Harry Potter. But Leavesden was, this was the first movie that was filmed at Leavesden. You know, it was built for the purpose of creating a space. They couldn't use Pinewood. They couldn't use Elstree or Shepperton. They were stuck for space. I think they went to the airship sheds at Cardington, RAF Cardington. They couldn't use that for various reasons. So they found this particular location, the old Rolls-Royce factory at Leavesden, as it was known then, Leavesden Studios as it became. But they created the whole thing, they flattened the whole thing, they started afresh. And Peter Lamont really was miraculous in his ability to create this working space out of almost nothing at all in a very short space of time. You know, to go in and say to folks, well, okay, we don't have, there's no telephone system in here, there's no plumbing in here, there's no nothing we need to create. And he created all of that on top of creating sets and various other bits and pieces as well. It's magnificent. And it's a very subdued location as well, because at the time, years later, I was on the Harry Potter set down there, and I stopped in the village of Leavesden, and this is before sat-navs were popular, and I was looking at my map thinking, what the hell am I? And I stopped in the village of Leavesden and asked this fellow where the film studio was, and of course he had no idea whatsoever. I said, no, how about the Rolls-Royce factory? He went, the what? You know, so they never even knew it was there. And it's over there, out of the way. But nowadays, of course, you know, millions of people flock to it the world over, because it's more or less in the same spot. But that space itself is for that entire street scene of St. Petersburg, where the police cars are getting crushed and people are jumping out of the way, and the Perrier wagon and all of that sort of stuff. That's all done there for real. And of course, Gary crashing through that wall. In the tank.
I've got one of those Perrier cans somewhere from the film.
I've
got a few bits from the film. That's, I don't know where it is. I've been kicking around for ages.
You'd have thought sparkling water would have cracked on by that time. People really going to catch on with the whole sparkling water thing?
Do you know what it was? They wanted Coke to sponsor it, but they weren't interested. Oh. So they ended up going to, because they knew they had this scene with cans, and it was a great moment for product placement. And, you know, that kind of product placement works well for me, because you do get lorries.
Exactly, yeah. Coke, as we know, would have probably been a very good aid for sliding tanks on tarmac. Large time spreading it about all over Matera. Just the science behind getting that tank to firstly get to a certain speed. Gary had to have, I don't know, mile and a quarter run up and then hit a ramp which was built the other side to propel him through the other side of the wall. And Steve Street, who I think must take a great deal of credit here, because he's the guy driving the car that has to pull out, turn left, and just be in foreground as Gary comes through that wall. You get the timing wrong on that thing, and he is done. You know, he's going to arrive underneath the tank at the wrong moment. So the timing was spectacular. Of course, as soon as Gary hit the floor, it nearly knocked him out cold. I mean, the force of that thing as it hit the ground, the tonnage of this vehicle. But a remarkable thing to see. And of course, you know, when they took it out to St. Petersburg, they had to make no end of changes to it to make it work properly. But Gary said himself, he said to Simon and Jim, best way to let me find out how I can utilize this particular machine, let me go and play with it. Let me take it out and play with it and see if I can come up with something, if I can slide it around, if I can do something with it. And that's what he did. And he took it out and took it around the place and found that, hang on, I can actually throttle and get the back end out at the same time. So he was playing with the whole tank and came up with that idea of, I can do this. I can do this for real. In that moment where he has to do a big donut in the middle of the road, I can do it in the tank. Oh, okay, let's see you do it. And they do, fantastic, right, let's keep that in. But that was just him playing with the idea and playing with the tank.
Mm.
And so to get to that stage where they took it out there, and of course they had tank technicians out there who looked at the tank layout because Gary had adjusted it slightly. He got all the dials and everything just right as he wanted it so that there was the right pressure at the right time. And these guys looked at it and went, oh, this is all wrong, and they changed it all back to its original. And he went, and it took like 2 days to get it right again. That was a massively important moment to be able to see that tank sliding about the place. And the amount of work that Gary did in that was incredible. They had to, you see a lot of the time where Pierce's head is stuck out here and he's driving it, because you can't drive it that way. You know, he's got to be inside it. And of course, they had to cut out a tiny little slit just in there so he can see where he's going. And only then could you just see the end of the gun turret. You know, it was perspective and all this sort of stuff was very tricky. It's a fantastic sequence.
I adore this sequence. I really do. I think it sums up Bond to me. You would only ever find someone driving a tanker in the middle of a city on a chase on a James Bond film. It would
happen in a suit.
And it's the fact that it's carrying on with the normality of life, crashing through Perrier's with crowds just walking past and looking at it.
Yep.
You will only find that in a James Bond film. And that is one of the main reasons I love James Bond.
I think what's so good about it is that although, you know, they haven't really destroyed half of the city, it looks realistic. Every shot looks like it's really happening.
Yes.
You take, I was on a plane and I watched, I think it was one of the Fast and Furious films, something, and it had a ridiculous chase sequence. I think it involved a submarine and a car or something.
Probably.
Oh, on the ice.
And there was lots of shots of CGI, and you could just tell, you know, even good CGI, quite often you can just tell it's not quite real.
Or expensive CGI, as it's otherwise known.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether it's good or not, it's cost a lot of money.
Very good, yeah.
Yeah, so for me, it was just ridiculous. Whereas this scene, because it's done kind of for real with a real tank, and you know they've made real buildings of a sort that are falling down around it, lots of shots of some pieces, but it's just so well done. Every shot looks believable in what is an insane chase. It's phenomenal.
There's a lovely moment later.
Out the window, doesn't it?
Exactly. There's a lovely moment later on after the chase. You know, the car's banged into the back, and he straightened his tie, and off he goes. And he's now in the tank, hiding on top of the bridge, watching the train.
Yeah.
You go, who hides in a tank? You know, only Bond. Only Bond would do that. There's a lot. My favourite moment.
That's 006's line, isn't it?
Yeah.
Only Bond.
My favourite moment in that, and it's those moments. Again, I'm a big fan of the blink and you'll miss it moments. But there's a guy knocked down on the bridge by a car. Urumov says, use the bumper, that's what it's for.
Yeah.
And he starts knocking people down. And on top of the bridge is a guy who is knocked down, goes up in the air and lands in the water. It's spectacular. Yeah. It's a bang moment. You go, how the hell did he do that? That's ridiculous. And I was originally told that was stuntman Andy Bennett. And then a bit later on, I got talking to somebody who said, one of the guys who worked on the picture, and said, no, this was a Russian stunt guy when we were out there, because this is a location shot. And I said, okay. I said, who was he? He said, nobody really knew what his name was. I went, right. He said, but he was an old stunt guy from, you know, done lots of Russian pictures and Eastern European pictures. And he approached the English guys who had gone over and said, you know, you're going to need, it's going to be, there's going to be a wire. It was a wire job. So you'd roll up the car, and then the wire would pull him clear of the edge of the bridge. So there was no chance of him falling on the bridge or under the wheels of the vehicle. He would definitely land in the water. So that would be the accelerant to pull him from one side to the other. They said, you know, you got all the right pads on. And he's going, I don't need pads. I'm Russian. I will do this. It's fine. Don't worry. He's going, no. You really need to take some the shoulders, and you know, there's going to be positioning. You're probably going to hit you with your shoulder here. But here, I've got some back pads. No, he's all right. That will be fine. Okay. Well, you know, it's your shout. And he did that. I think he must have had, he had a pelvis pad on, hips. That was about it. And you see him go through the air like a bowling ball, up in the air and then bang into the water. All right, he's attached to a wire. But nevertheless, you know, anybody who gets knocked down by a car on purpose, everybody's different. This guy will wear different padding to this guy because this guy's built differently to this guy. So, but this guy said, no, it's fine. Don't worry. It's okay. Okay. And action. And off he goes. Back. Nearly threw himself into the air. But those moments, you know, you look at that and go, that's spectacular. And I'd never seen that before. That it's going passing through shot and this guy gets knocked down. It's fantastic. So there's a lot of that going on. And again, that's credit to Simon Crane and the team for creating this and creating these magical moments. But there's masses of it. I mean, the film's just loads of it. It really is.
There's a throwaway stunt, which I won't mention now, but it's at the end of the film, or towards the end of the film, which I have spoken to you about, John, previously a few months ago. But it's a shot I love, and it's 2 seconds long. It's an amazing stunt, I think. But I'll let Tom guide us through the
film. No, I'm
ahead.
Please mention it now, well, because otherwise we'll forget, won't we?
Well, it's on the climactic scene with Alec Trevelyan and Bond up on the satellite thing, and Bond is running away. He's on the top on the white big metal frame of it. He's running, and I think Alec shoots, and the bullets ricochet off, and Bond does a kind of fall down the stairs, but it's a sort of, he turns into a kind of somersault as he goes down and then just carries on. But this is on solid metal. You know, imagine just throwing yourself head first down some stairs and rolling and landing at the bottom. I think it's an amazing stunt, but it's one of those stunts that you blink and you miss it because there's no attention drawn to it.
It is. It's a fascinating, fascinating gag, and is, you know, one of those moments where you look at it and go, well, surely that has to be, you know, they've changed the angle of the whole thing or done something with it. But it's a remarkable dive and is done for real. There's no two ways about that. It's one of those extraordinary moments where you just think that he's got to get from A to B, and his start off position and his landing position. He's at full stretch, a full dive, and then I think they catch it from the other angle as he comes back down the stairs and lands at the bottom. It's very, very impressive, I must admit. There's no, and again, that's doing it for real. That's the key to all of this is getting it done properly, being able to do it to the best of everyone's ability, really. I think is to say how good these things really are, and you have those moments where you have to do it. You know, particularly in pictures like this, you can't mess about with it. But again, those throwaway moments, as they may be, but they are essential to sidetracking people momentarily and going, wait a second, did I really just see that? You know, was that something that I just saw caught out the corner of my eye? And certainly Jamie Edgell, who's the guy who was doubling Pierce there, does a remarkable job. They split it between the two of them. Jamie Edgell crops up earlier on. He's the guy on the manticore on the boat Pierce attacks with the towel. He's the guy on there. Well, he also doubles Pierce later on. Him and Wayne split the doubling between them. From a gymnastic perspective, that's some dive, right? And then you've got to do it going downhill and on a few steps. And you wear some, he's got a little, what's he got, like a waistcoaty type jacket on. And so there's room to put some padding on it and bits and pieces. I always feel very sorry for Tracy Edden, who is doubling Isabella during the picture. She's in, she's got an old cardi on, all right. She's got a skirt and she's got tights on. So at least she can put pads on But she's getting chucked about left, right, and center. She's also married to Wayne Michaels. So it's a nice husband and wife duo routine going on there.
No chance in choosing their own career, have they, really?
No, that's it. That's the problem. We're particularly in situations like that, you know, we talked about Sid Charles being knocked down in For Your Eyes Only in a bikini. You know, you can't hide pads nowadays. They've developed them where you can have little, you know, your elbows and knees can be covered. But that's it. Well, luckily, she's... In this instance, Tracy's got a bit of a cardi on, and at least she's wearing clothes of some shape or form. Not a great deal, though, and there's those explosions going on of all sorts, so she's having to dive. It's a very physical role, I think, for Isabella, really. It's another – they get more physical as time goes on.
There's another stunt woman who's in it who, of course – is Eunice Huthart, who won Gladiators, didn't she?
That's right.
who was so famous, wasn't she, when it was absolutely massive, Gladiators. The UK version, this is.
Yeah.
And she was just incredible on that show. And then to hear that she was a stunt woman, and she was doubling at points for Xenia on top.
She was, in that she doubled Xenia in the... Originally, she was brought on because of her gymnastic ability and for the sauna scene, and that was it originally. So there are moments in that sauna scene where Wayne is doubling Pierce, Eunice is doubling Famke, and they're in close-up. You know, that scene as they walk in and she comes over and jumps up and kicks him head high, that's all her. And that's all Wayne. And also that moment where, she flips him over on the bench, jumps on top of him, that's all the two of them together as well. But again, that's the credit to the way in which it's edited and the way that how good the doubles were. You don't look at it at the time. Later on, you've got the ability to go DVD and Blu-ray and half frame, etc. You can just check it out and make sure it isn't, you know. But Eunice, being Eunice, had no genuinely thought that they were taking the piss when they rang her and said, we're the Bond folk and we'd very much like you to come down and do some stunt work for us, whatever, and kept hanging up. She hung up half a dozen times before Simon Crane or somebody else had to ring up and go, look, don't hang up, ring us back, here's the number, just, you know, do whatever neat checks you need to do at your end, but we're serious, we'd like to have you. And that's how that started. And then later on she gets used as the for Xenia's death scene, as she's hoisted using what was referred to years ago as a jerk harness and now would be called a ratchet, where she's fired up into the tree and gives that fabulous scream on the way past. So there's all of that, and that fight as well. There's a little fight, which, if you remember, the fight between her and Bond and Isabella was edited. Isabella grabs hold of her and Famke says, wait your turn, and then headbutts her. You know, that was all taken out of the edit I remember on the TV. I don't think I saw it on VHS, actually, for quite some time. So there was that fight as well, but that's why she was brought in, on the basis of that. And I interviewed Eunice 20 years ago, probably now. Made the mistake of doing it in Liverpool at a restaurant, and walked down the road from the train. She met me at the train station. She'd already been mobbed. It was like Beatlemania. So she'd already been mobbed there, and then met me at the station, and we walked down to the restaurant. We walked in the restaurant, and the guy said, hello, you. How you doing, love? You know what I say? What are you in for? She says, well, I'd like to do an interview with your man. All right. Well, I find you somewhere quiet. Hang on, love. And so they went off and found a little snug somewhere. There was just the three of us, me and Eunice and a photographer. And so we managed to get sort of half an hour, 40 minutes of calm before we went back up. She said, I'll go first, lads. Okay, yeah, no bother. And so she went, and we were upstairs, and we could hear, hey, there she is, she's over there, hello, Yoon. Of course, we're sat in there going, bloody hell, I hope she's all right, are they? And Dave, who was the photographer, said, she'll be able to look after herself, I imagine, or possibly run away. She's very nice. Oh, yeah, fair enough, yeah, that's true. She's fitter than the rest, I imagine. She's a force of nature.
She is. It never got televised. But she actually, on the Gladiators tour, after she won it, got picked to be a gladiator. So on the actual tour, like, she was one of the, I don't know what her name was, but she was a gladiator next to Jet and Lightning, but it just never got televised. I mean, how on earth does a contestant then just become a gladiator? That's unbelievable.
Yeah. There's got to be a great quiz question in that. What would Eunice Huthart's gladiator name be?
Let me find it for you.
cop off or something. I don't know. It must be there's something football, Liverpool related. Yeah, she was extraordinary. And then, of course, you know, you think that, and not for a moment am I suggesting that, you know, she got the whole thing by accident. She didn't. Obviously, they've looked at her and they've said she's the best person for the job because of ability that she had, and they wanted a particular look. And that's always very important as well when you're trying to double somebody. It's all very well finding somebody who's great at doing what they do, but if they don't look like the person they're trying to double or can't be formed into that, that's going to be tricky. So she looks that way. And of course, she's gone on to the most extraordinary things. Yeah. You know, doubling Angelina Jolie for probably most of her career. And she was the stunt coordinator on the last Star Wars movie. You know, I mean, that's how it's got to that stage. She's just gone from small beginnings and bigger and bigger and better, you know, so extraordinary.
Her gladiator name was Blaze.
Blaze.
Cop off would have been better. Cop off. John, you were right.
Blaze. I don't know. Blaze makes her sound like a pony. that's me favourite. Oh, is Blaze. Hello, son. I don't know. Yeah, Blaze.
I've been listening. I've been watching the Get Back documentary. You doing these Eunice Huffart impressions. It's just like...
So, well, she didn't appear in that, unfortunately. Look, if you don't want me to play, George, you won't play. There was all of that. But I find somebody does an extraordinary impression of all four of the Beatles, and they're all slightly different sounds. Paul McCartney was always the most difficult. George was down here all the time, and Ringo the same. But Paul's very different. He's a very different area.
Yeah.
You know, Paul's very much like that. Paul, I have to talk with my eyes when I'm doing Paul. But anyway, not taking anything away from the Liverpool accent for a moment. And if I've offended anybody, I apologise, but it is only Tuesday. So if you wait till the end of the week, I'm bound to have offended the rest of you as well. We'll do a big package deal, possibly, as the case goes on.
You offend everyone, it's not offensive.
That's it. That's the point. Right there. So, yeah, she's an extraordinary force of nature as Eunice. I don't know. I think it's marvellous that she's gone from strength to strength. Also, we should mention that it's a Rémy Julien picture as well.
Yeah.
Because of that DB5 and Ferrari chase. A lot of people always wanted to know who doubled Xenia in that. And I have to say, it was a man. Christophe Vezon. Is the guy, ex-rally driver, who was doing a large proportion of the doubling in that for her. And on, again, another Rémy invention, but the carousel, the moving carousel. So you have a piece of equipment that moves horizontally and then spins as well. So that whole moment where the car is spinning, they can put the actors and do the whole shot. So very clever piece of, you know, equipment. Yeah. But very exciting stuff there. So there we are. That's Rémy's moment in GoldenEye.
I mean, we could go on about GoldenEye forever, couldn't we? I just love it so much.
There's masses of it, but sadly, there are many more bots.
We got to get through it.
Yes. Before Easter.
If you're enjoying Really 007, why not follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram? Look us up at Really 007 Pod.
Tomorrow Ever Dies. Again, that's got a heck of a lot going on, hasn't it? The most famous one would be the motorbike jump over the helicopter, probably. Now, that's something that doesn't quite get as much attention as it should, maybe. I'm slipping! Stop fidgeting back there. What are you?
I once asked Vic where he found Jean-Pierre Goy out of all of the people in the world, and he'd got many, many top motorcyclists working as part of the stunt team. Everybody was very capable of riding a motorcycle. So why this guy? And he said quite happily one day he got somebody to do the job, but he still had doubts. There was something in the back of his mind that was playing him up. Anyway, he got home one night and was stuck on the telly while he was having a bite to eat, and there was a World's Greatest Stunts thing on one of the dusty channels at the satellite, and he was watching that, and it was a guy who was riding a motorcycle over the edge, a bit like you know the movie A Bridge Too Far, well, very similar to the bridge there at Arnhem.
Don't get any ideas.
I've no
never dream of it.
He was riding his motorcycle over the top steelwork of the bridge, all the way over the top and right the way down the other side. And the only protection he had, of course, he had water on one side, and the other side was a small flatbed lorry with some mattresses in the back, which are about 60 feet away. So should he fall that way, he'd have to pick his spot very carefully. And he looked at this guy and went, Jesus, this guy's amazing. And then realised that it was this guy Jean-Pierre Goy, made a phone call and said, I need to get hold of this guy, I don't know where he is, but I need to get hold of him. And within 24 hours they found him, got him on a flight, got him over to the UK. He said, what motorcycle am I riding? Vic pointed at the BMW and Jean-Pierre went, are you serious? Really? He said, yeah, that's the bike. He went, oh, okay, give me half an hour. So gets on the bike and says, right, let me see what I can do with this thing. And then starts to get to a stage where, you know, he could put that thing on the back wheel and take it for miles on the back wheel. He was already the world wheelie champion, I think he could do 8 or 9 miles on the back wheel on a particular vehicle. So, you know, this was no issue to him whatsoever. The jump, well, the jump is, you know, a motorcycle jump is a motorcycle jump. Different motorcycles mean different positioning, different power means you have to work it differently. This one's supposed to have a passenger on the back, which of course they didn't have for the take itself, it was a dummy. But the building opposite was made of cardboard boxes, you know, and it was filmed in such a way that landing, and he lands right in the middle, and then there's a lovely scene afterwards where Dickie Beer, the stunt arranger, goes in to go and get him, hook him up on wires and bring him out from the boxes, and that was pretty exciting. They went, obviously they CGI'd the propellers of the helicopter on afterwards, but nevertheless a very exciting thing. Lots of stuff leading up to that is exciting as well, because you've got all of those shots of Wendy Leach on the back and they're swapping positions, and you know, she's at the back and now she's at the front.
Get on the back of the bike.
What, are you trying to protect me?
No, I need to balance the bike. Get on the back.
They've got the handcuffs on, and that was the whole key to the thing, is that the handcuffs are on, so yeah. One of them operates the clutch and one of them's operating the accelerator. They looked at this and thought, look, there's got to be a simpler way than it, because the positioning of my hands here are tricky if you've got your arm over here and that one over there, and we can't operate the bike correctly, and there are moments where you need to see the bike moving quite freely from one position to another or going through shot, and you don't need to have this very awkward positioning that they've got of one hand over here, she's got the clutch here and he's got the accelerator. So they worked a very clever way of being able to do it, where they had a shirt, they had the red shirt or the blue shirt which had a red sleeve, that's what they did, so they changed it. So those moments where you see the two of them sometimes together, it's actually Pierce has hold of the motorcycle, particularly when they're going through some of the crowd of people towards the end of the sequence where the propellers, the helicopter's coming down and cutting up the stalls that are nearby. All of that was done that way. But it's a remarkable sequence. It's very, very good. And you do tend to... somebody mentioned at the time that, you know, are they just throwing action sequences at the audience for the sake of not having much story? Well, I don't know. I think that the action sequences were good enough to let the story continue throughout.
Absolutely.
You know, we had to know that this character, Weyland, was as good as this character, yeah, Bond, you know, and the two of them can work together. Well, what better way to get them in a situation where they're hanging outside of a building, firstly, yeah, right, and then the motorcycle chase, you know.
How did they do that with the banner? You know, they're going...
Banner was, that was filmed here in the UK. They had a building, and there was Mark Southworth was doubling for Pierce. Danny Bernett was doubling for Wei Lin. And as they come down the building, and of course they're wired, you can see in some of the photographs, some of the images, when you see them coming down and they're doing that squealing thing as they're holding onto the thing, they've obviously got quite an array of cabling and padding underneath, harnesses on. But that was done for real. So the section, the high part of it, the crashing through the window and all that sort of stuff was done here, but that was stunt doubles. The rest of it was Pierce and Michelle.
We can use the banner.
Get up to them!
Ready?
Go!
Oh.
I take the elevator.
But again, a very good sequence. Well, one nice thing between the two, if you want to tie things up, Danny Bennett was married to Peter Braham, who was a very successful stuntman and stunt coordinator, but he was Rhoda in From Russia With Love. So they managed to tie the whether that was done intentionally or not, I don't know, but certainly Danny was a and still is a very fine performer and coordinator these days. So she managed to get herself on in the Bond franchise the way her husband had got in there as well.
Steve, I don't know what your thoughts on Tomorrow Never Dies are.
No, I think it. When I first saw it at the cinema, I was a bit disappointed, but I think it's hard to follow GoldenEye because I thought that film was spectacular. But it's grown on me a lot over time. And in fact, I watched it again 3 or 4 months ago and I really enjoyed it, particularly because I'm a big fan of W1A. And actually, I noticed that two of the actors from W1A are in the Marine, which really thrilled me. But I think it's a really fun Bond film that has aged very well because it's just become one of those Bond films you look back on, and actually now it's great fun. It's got good characters, good action. I don't think it's quite as impressive as GoldenEye, and I don't think the characters are quite as well-rounded. But there's some great scenes. I love that fight scene, actually, in the club, and you can just see Pierce fighting the heavies in the background in a soundproof room.
It's a soundproof room, Mr. Bond. Nobody hears you scream. Estampa,
we have made contact. Make him uncomfortable. I'll be there in a few moments.
I think that's a great sequence with that all happening in the background. I think you've got to try and remember it now. You've got the security guy in the foreground and he's looking in the wrong direction. You can just see this massive fight going on.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I think that's a great scene.
You seem very concerned about Mr. Carver's business. He wants to know why.
Why did I do it, you ask?
That Rocky, wasn't it?
Rocky and Terry Plummer is the guy who sat there drinking the tea, and he was the guy, him and Rocky both fought Roger in Man with the Golden Gun, and they're in the that room where they're looking for the bullet that Saeed is wearing. And there are those lovely comedic moments where you look up and suddenly Pierce has got a cello in his hand, you know? This sort of pops out of nowhere.
Put him into jail, maybe we play a little number on his head.
And what do I expect in return? Worldwide domination.
Complete, utter, total worldwide domination. But not of a government, of ideology, of a tyranny, and isolation, and... The media group network has the ability to reach every person, in every village, in every nation. But do not fear me. But tonight, I offer you my declaration of principle.
Terry Richards is in there. Terry Richards was the swordsman from Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, you know, they're all in there giving it 10 to the dozen. And then Rocky then crashes through the window with Wayne. And then, of course, there's a lovely story attached to that. He said to Pierce, right, you need to pick up the ashtray and then give it over the top of Rocky's head. He said, okay. And so he goes off and he picks up. And he does this thing that he didn't do in rehearsal, which was weighing it in his hand. Like, is this going to be heavy enough? He does that thing and then goes, whack! And then Rocky hit the floor. Right, cut. And Rocky stayed there. And, Pierce went, are you okay? He said, yeah, it's all right. I'm acting, Pierce. all right. See, yeah, fair enough. But there's moments there which are terrific. You know, that's old school type knockabout comedic fun. You know, where better to have a fight than in a soundproof room? Of course, the guy's not going to hear anything. He's quite happily sipping his tea, watching the broadcast, or chaos behind him. And then you go from that to, you know, the Michelle Yeoh fights, which are orchestrated much faster, you know, because she brought in Philip Kwok just on the basis that, and nothing against the guys, the stunt guys here, but we don't do fights at that speed. You know, the from a fighting perspective, these are very specialized types of fights. She is able to do a great deal of it herself. Not all of it. I mean, I will say that, you know, there's a lot of people go, oh, Michelle Yeoh, she does all of her own fights. She doesn't do all of her own. She is doubled on a number of occasions during this fight in her career, to be fair, if the truth be known. But there are moments where she is doubled. Her double is a guy called Yung Tak Ngai, who has doubled her on a number of occasions. That moment when she runs up the wall, comes over, that's him. There's a couple of occasions in that fight where she's doubled, stuff that she doesn't need to do, even though, you know, she wants to do it. Look, she's the female Jackie Chan, surely she can do it. Yeah, but the insurance company say she's not going to be able to do it, you know. So on the strength of that, they bring Philip Kwok in, and he says, I've got an idea, why don't we do this? So that's simpler to do it that way.
Does she do the stunts for when she goes, yeah?
She does her own shouting, most definitely. Yeah, I think she's, as shouting goes, she's top draw. She really is top draw. And does do a lot of her own action. There's no toys about that. I mean, she hasn't got to being, you know, Asia's greatest action female action star by being doubled every 5 minutes. I mean, she does do it herself, but what she does on Police Story 3, for instance, she isn't allowed to do on Tomorrow Never Dies. And of course, you know, you maybe she's concerned about getting typecast as well. That's a consideration. You don't, and as she's proved in later films, you know, she's been in a number of pictures playing straight roles, and a number of pictures being, you know, that link character between main story and the next part, you know. So it certainly worked in her favor and gave her a bigger audience to go on. No two ways.
The modern classic Last Christmas.
The modern Christmas.
Yeah,
classic,
I saw it.
It is, yes.
Yeah. It wasn't as dreadful as I would say.
It wasn't at all. It wasn't perfectly watchable, wasn't it?
Yeah. And obviously, I love George Michael, so that helped.
Yeah. Anyway, waking me up before we go, though.
Yeah.
If I may be so bold.
In Tomorrow Never Dies, you've got the remote control car sequence is a big one, isn't it?
Yeah. We mentioned him earlier, but Steve Griffin, who was the guy who was driving the car just in front of the tank in Goldeneye, is the guy who does all the blind driving on this. And this is in the days before miniature cameras. So he is literally sat behind the driving seat on the floor of the back seat. So he sat there, he's covered in there's black cloth all over the place, and he's looking through a tiny camera that's at his feet with steering wheels, and he's got the foot controls. And, you know, to do what he did there, I thought was phenomenal. There's some terrific moments. And you know, look at Pierce's expression on his face. He's absolutely loving it in that car. He is being thrown around for real in there, you know. There are shots where the camera guy is in the passenger seat filming Pierce in the back as he's being thrown about the back seat. And he's loving it. He's absolutely loving it. Also, the great thing about this movie is it's probably the first time where flocks of, you know, fans the world over go and see a bloody car park. I've been to Brent Cross on numerous occasions. This is the place. This is the one here. Look, this is the staircase. Yeah, down the stairs. You know, you do it. You do it because it's part of a Bond film. It was great.
Huge. I remember that scene did offend me a little bit in the cinema because we talked about product placement earlier, but it is literally a scene. It's 3-4 minutes of product placement with this ridiculous family saloon that you'd expect a bank manager to be driving. And then you've got the Avis stuff everywhere, including Desmond Llewellyn's costume.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got the phone. I think it's a Nokia he's got. Clearly didn't do massive.
Ericsson, yeah.
Ericsson, is it? Didn't do wonders, clearly, the product placement, because everyone's got an iPhone now. But, it was just packed in, the product placement in that sequence. And the car's the bit that offends me the most, actually. The choice of car, this family saloon,
I think that they
forced it.
They sold a lot of the stuff, the Z3 in the previous movie, and didn't use it, you know.
Mm.
You know, consequently, they've said, right, we've really got to put the kitchen sink in here and throw everything at the screen. So all of a sudden, in this entire chase sequence, he's used every possible means of artillery he's got in the car.
He used a bigger car because they just couldn't fit. They couldn't fit a stunt driver, could they, in a Z3?
You can barely fit a passenger in a Z3.
I remember reading it was part of the deal was that one of the cars that would be used would have to be a saloon as opposed to a sports car. I remember that was part of BMW's deal.
Most partridge deal I ever heard.
It's a partridge deal.
It has to be a saloon.
And I'd rather it was a Rover.
I'm not going to have a mini metro.
Not driving
a mini metro.
No.
Yeah, but it's a class sequence, isn't it? And is Rocky in that? Is he one of the guys trying to
hit the windscreen with a sledgehammer? Yeah.
He said,
do you know how difficult it is to swing a rubber sledgehammer? I said, that's one question that nobody's ever asked me before. No, I don't know. He says, that's acting, my friend. Says, you convinced me.
Rocky the guy? Sorry, just so when you said about like smashing his head with the ashtray, he's the hashtag.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent.
Yeah. There was a number of them, and they all said, can you say this line? Herr Stamper, we can't. No, do it in a German accent. What? Do it in a German accent. Herr Stamper, we cannot get into the car. And he says, is that German? I don't know. Maybe it is. Anyway, you know, for half a dozen of them tried it. And they went, oh, Rocky, you have it. So he had it. So he managed to get the line, which is...
That scene is brilliant because it's a great laugh, isn't it? With the torture scene. He's being threatened with torture. And then it's the... I'm very embarrassed. I need to ask you this.
I don't know what to say. Yeah, I don't. It's lovely. He's you know, he really does. I would say...
Good.
I would say he's one of the best... characters that turns up in, like, it's, you know, I don't know how long that scene is, 6 minutes maybe, if that, it's 5 or 6 minutes. He's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. You know, did you try the auto club? You know, for God's sake,
yes,
all of these questions that everybody else is asking, why are you asking me? You know, feedback in his ear, brilliant. I mean, he's a great comic turn done there, and it's a great scene, but he's only a professional doing a job, you know,
yeah.
It is
very popular with Bond fans, particularly Dr. Carefully.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
This is a tale of the supernatural.
The Tapes, a podcast of the uncanny.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Join me, host Christopher Goldie, and guests as we discuss the best in unsettling television and film.
Who is this? Who is coming?
Find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. Search for at the Tapes Pod, part of the Pod Dojo Network.
Should we move on to the film that John Kell has been championing ever since we started this podcast?
The Twine.
Well, it was not enough.
Twine. Yeah.
And Hook. I mean, let's not forget Hook.
Yeah.
One day I'll start my own Hook podcast. It'll be me on my own, and I'll be the only listener. But
I know I'll contribute, and you can contribute to Superman 3 the podcast. John's been a massive fan, and it's that. Again, the pre-title sequence, this is, it's just expected by now, and it's just getting ridiculous.
Well, it's true, but I mean, the pre-title sequence was never going to be 18 minutes long.
You know, yeah,
the pre-title sequence was going to end when he bails out of the building. That was it.
Yeah, good, but
which is fine, you know, and you've got a number of terrific moments in there when you consider that Mark Mottram is, who again was Gladiators. We make that connection. He was on Gladiators. Mark Mottram is now doubling Bond. He jumps out of the window with the briefcase, with the suitcase there in wherever it was. Where was it?
It was Bilbao.
Bilbao. There we are. I haven't remembered.
I nearly said it was in Materia, because obviously the bit of a copy that I've seen in.
He does that. Of course, I'd do it a couple of times. Firstly, on a wire, and then secondly, a free fall into a bag. His counterbalance, if you will, is Wade Eastwood, who then is the guy who drives the Q boat with Gary Powell and then goes on to coordinate all the action on the Mission Impossible films. Ray DeHaan is one of the guys in the office as well, who was driving the Aston for Pierce on the ice in Die Another Day. And Paul Jennings is in there as well. Paul Jennings, who I don't know if you ever saw it. If you haven't seen it, you can go to my YouTube channel and find it. There is a program that Desmond Wilcox used to present. Desmond Wilcox used to be married to Esther Ranson. They had a program called The Visit, and he would follow people's journeys in life. And one of those was Paul Jennings, who wanted to be a stuntman. This is his story going from when he wanted to join the race to doing his first stunt work. Well, he is in this sequence as well. So yeah, they just, you know, they did that action sequence. You go, okay, fair enough, that's fine. But then all of a sudden, it goes to this and again, Vic had to suddenly find the criteria, which was we need to find as many visitor-driven locations along the Thames that we can add into the whole thing. Of course, the most complicated thing was allowing the boats to fly past the Houses of Parliament.
They were complaining, weren't they?
They were complaining of the noise.
Yeah. Jack Straw said, no, it's all right. It's a Bond film.
It's a Bond film. It'll be all right, said Jack.
I mean, watching Prime Minister's Questions, noise isn't usually frowned upon there, is it? So, and to be honest,
the last thing, are you worried about having a boat?
Yeah, it's a far more constructive white noise having a hover boat fly past than rather somebody answering about somebody's party being locked.
Of course, the boats that they were using, they came from New Zealand, I think, was originated where they came from, and they could operate in 6 inches of water. So the idea was to test them, and they took them down to Hawley Lake. Simon Crane was testing them down there, and they got to a stage where they were trying to barrel roll the boat onto dry land. And that was the plan. And there's footage of them with box rigs on the shore and the boat coming up and flipping over and landing in the boxes. But it started to get a bit complicated. And again, Dave Bickers saved the day, because Dave Bickers said, do me a favour and hang the boat up by its nose from a crane here. And so they did that. And he said, look, I can spin this with my hand. There's no weight in it. So he said, when it's airborne, you can do whatever you want with it. So the idea was then to have two pistons, one nitrogen piston firing down and one nitrogen piston firing up. And so he designed the fact that when Gary Powell, who was driving the boat for the turnover, also Gary was always going to do that, because when Simon said, who wants to turn the boat over? Gary was already fighting his way to the front going, I'll do it. So he had to hit the ramp and push the button at exactly the same moment so that they would fire independently, fire it. You've got to do two independent fires, both sides, to get it back onto its belly again. Unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, a really spectacular job. Edited beautifully as well. Looks magnificent.
How he catches the rope.
That's a separate gag. But I mean, that's it, on its own, you know, that was done for real. That's Mark Mottram in the boat, jumping from the boat and grabbing hold of a rope, which he will never hang on to. Because of the physics behind the whole thing, he's not wearing gloves. He's got he's just bare hands. And Vic said, "You've got to grab that rope." He said, "I'll grab it, but I'm never going to hang on to it." He said, "Just grab the rope. We'll do the rest in the edit." And sure enough, he goes and he dives and he's got the rope. And that's when they then cut to the next shot. But as soon as he grabbed that, he started sliding down it, because he's got no purchase on it whatsoever, and the rope is getting slightly damp because of the conditions. And so he's only just got a moment of contact on it. What? Also, I think we should say something about Sarah Donahue, who was responsible for driving the Sunseeker in this, purely on the basis that she nearly died soon afterwards. She was a professional powerboat racer and was in a horrible accident in Italy, which nearly took her life. The job she did on this, nobody, there are many girls on the register who can drive boats, but not many of them have the same experience as Sarah. And she was brought in as a professional powerboat racer to be able to throw this Sunseeker about, and she really does throw it about. I must admit that at 40 and 50 miles an hour down those stretches of canal, which you have probably never seen anything like it in their lives. So that was she really did throw the kitchen sink at that. And then Joe McLaren does the other physical doubling. So when the boat lands on dry land just at the dome, she then runs along the top of it before it explodes and all that sort of stuff. So a lot of great work going on there. And of course, a huge sequence cut out of the picture. Huge moment where there was another major sequence of the car being chased down streets and an opening sequence into Terry Bamber's restaurant, Vic's Bistro, or whatever they called it. I forget what they called it at the time. But so Terry played the part of the waiter. So he has a little moustache and he walks up to people's tables and taking drinks and things, and then it cuts away to another piece of the chase, then it cuts back to something in the restaurant, then cuts away, and then Gary comes in through the wall in the boat. So yeah, extraordinary stuff going on. But again, as real as the only piece of CGI in that, incidentally, are the two torpedoes in the water. Everything else in that sequence is real, which I think is fantastic. I mean, really, really sensational. Nowadays, a great deal of that would all be done.
You can tell.
In computer.
You can really tell. That to me is one of the reasons why Twine... So I need to start calling it Twine. It's a horrible name. Twine is not enough. The story's brilliant. I appreciate some people saying that maybe the action, apart from this scene, is a bit stilted. But when you compare it... And I'm not a Die Another Day hater by any stretch. But for something that's only 3 years later, my word, can you tell that a lot more of this is actual stunt work,
this is real,
as opposed to CGI, and it's so much better for it.
Yeah, they do a great deal of, you know, again, they're still doing as much real stuff as possible, the skiing stuff as well. You know, that's all real. These are real flying machines, you know. These are real explosions in Chamonix. Steve and Dan doesn't get half as many credits as he possibly should do. But everybody knows who Rick Sylvester is. Nobody has a clue who Stephen Dan is. And yet, you know, Rick doubles Roger skiing off the cliff in Spy Who Loved Me, and Stephen Dan doubles Pierce in this sequence. That one, there's a fabulous moment, which is, I think it was on a DVD cover, it was on posters, it was on lots of publicity. He jumps in the air, that big explosion goes off behind him, you know?
Yeah.
That's amazing. And that was all him, you know, and he's never really spoken about in the same, you know, in the same way as Willie Bogner or guys, Johnny Eaves or guys of this nature. And Francine Morillon was the double for herself in the film, you know. So the skiing stuff's terrific, but they had to move quite quickly. There was lots of avalanches at that period, but a lot of people were snowed in, so it was very treacherous. They managed to get as much done as they possibly could, but I think it's great fun. It's a great fun movie. I enjoy it enormously.
Steve, I'm worried about it. You don't quite rate it as highly as certainly John did.
It's a funny one, actually, because as I said, when I saw Tomorrow Never Dies at the cinema, I was a bit disappointed following Goldeneye. And then when I saw The World Is Not Enough, I walked out thinking, wow, we're almost back at Goldeneye. That was phenomenal. And then, but with time, I've switched in that I now prefer Tomorrow Never Dies because it's just fun, real fun from beginning to end. And that there's obviously more drama in The World Is Not Enough. And I do find it just drags a little bit in a couple of places. And I think they should have, I think the bad guy, what's his name? The guy who's never...
Robert Carlyle.
I don't think enough is done with him. They build him up to be this guy who doesn't feel pain. And then apart from the scene where she's rubbing ice on him, you don't really get that. The fight scene, there's nothing made of the fact that he doesn't feel pain. So I think that was a bit wasted. Although it was on your podcast about The World Is Not Enough, where I did slightly reconsider that in the suggestion that it was all a deception. It was to throw the viewer off. So you're looking at him as the bad guy. So I can actually, if that is what they were trying to do, I take that on board and think, actually, you know, that's not such a bad thing to distract you from her being
There's also a great deal of helping the audience out with story because we haven't told enough story to let them know where we are now. That that moment where the doctor, there's the hologram of Renard's head. Oh. She's explaining, and he gets stronger by the day and feels no pain. This is for the audience's point of view to go, incidentally, in case you weren't aware, we're just going to let you know that that bullet in his head makes him stronger and he feels no pain. Are you all right with that? Fine. Yeah. Okay, well, then we'll move on. You know, it's that moment where they're just clarifying everything, I think, as go along. There's a couple of
They never really see that through, do they? You expect the fight scene with Pierce where he's trying, you know, effectively seems he's going to lose the fight because this guy is getting stronger and feeling no pain. And you don't really, get that at all.
Quite small. It doesn't mean he's hard just because he can't feel it.
Yeah, and that came up in your podcast too. And I hadn't considered the fact that he's a little guy, especially next to Pierce. But now, again, I think perhaps that does take away some of the threat and that he just doesn't seem physically strong. I mean, you can be short and look strong, but he doesn't really look that either because he's quite wiry, isn't he, Robert Carlyle?
Well, yeah.
You tell him. I'm going to tell him. Oh, is that right?
Let JOHN just briefly defend.
It's old. I don't need to defend it. We're not like the Twitter universe. We're happy to accept everybody's point of view.
Oh, but and hey, it's up there in my top. It's always in my top 15, and that's a really good place to be. I don't think it's a bad Bond film. I don't think it's a bad Bond film at all. I'm just literally saying of the Brosnan ones, it's my third favourite. They go in order of of them being shot.
I mean, when you come back to the Brosnan films, I think one of the criticisms that they get, and I think it's incredibly unfair, is that they're all a bit formulaic and run of the mill. And I'm sorry, I just don't agree with that in the slightest. I think they have the perfect balance of putting twists on them. So every film of Brosnan's has a twist in it. So it's either 006, it's ex-friend, Paris Carr is ex-lover, World Is Not Enough, it's the lover actually turns out to be the main villain. There's twists that have never happened in Bond before, but there's Dying of a Day, he gets tortured, I suppose, you know. And
Colonel Moon.
Yeah, all right, Colonel Moon. Okay. but there's enough familiarity there for it to still feel like Bond. And I feel that is, to me, the balance. Now, I'm lost. I'm completely lost. That last film was an abomination.
Shout out to Lorenzo. Yeah. Well,
but anyway, we're not up to that yet. We'll have to review that.
No, 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 let's not bring the dampers down on it just yet.
Before John goes, he wants to get that in, I think. The world is not enough, yeah.
Yeah, but, so...
Any more standout ones? The Caviar Factory?
Caviar Factory is great fun. And again, I'd like more to have happened there. The set was huge. Mm. Absolutely huge, built around the tank at Pinewood. And apart from demolish the main building and then, you know, have the... I mean, a lot of these have the car chopped in half and a few other bits and pieces. I don't know, you could have done that maybe in a smaller location, a smaller set. But from an action point of view, I think the stunt guys have done a terrific job again. And certainly some of the sliding the rope from one side, or not the rope, but he's got the wire and he hooks it over and goes from one side to the other. The fall down the stairs is very impressive because he appears to arrive at the bottom and go, whew, and then go off, you know. And But I mean, that's the thing about the Pierce movies. He goes through all of this action and violence and all sorts of bits and pieces. He jumps from the tower into the water next to the submarine.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, gets aboard and he's in there and, all right, he's a bit wet, but he still looks in fairly decent nick and that shirt looks very clean. And that was the sort of the benchmark, really, was that clean and tidy GoldenEye thing, you know, where it doesn't matter what he does, he looks clean and tidy.
Just made me think, I don't want to moan about this film because I do like it, but in that caviar scene, you're just starting to see the CGI creeping in with those blades that shoot around, and they don't look very good. And you'd think when they came to the next Brosnan film, that goes, you know, one bit of that film looked a bit dodgy was the CGI.
Let's
not do so much CGI because it's clearly not our thing. Yeah. And then they went and literally filled the next film with terrible CGI.
Well, let's go into Dine of the Day because I do agree.
Hang on, I'll get my tablets.
Yeah. Sorry, Steve. Of course, the chase on the ice, the incredible car chase and all that.
Yeah.
Most of that's real and it sort of gets overlooked sometimes.
Yeah, I think so. I think that the ice chase is magnificent. I've got it's one of my two least favourite Bond films, and certainly
it's one of them quite recent.
Yeah, and certainly as far as high points are concerned, I don't find that many, but a number of the action sequences, particularly the ballet on the ice, is magnificent. It's beautifully done. It's very well filmed. I have no issue with that rotoscoping thing they do either. I think that's lovely. The editing shot where it does that and zooms into the action that's going on to speed up the I think that's terrific. Good. The two drivers, Georgie Cottle, who's doubling Zhao, and Ray DeHaan, are chosen because of their ability behind the wheel. The vehicles have been designed accordingly so that they aren't quite as powerful as maybe they should be. They're a V8, they go back to a V6. You know, they have to have some room at the front to put the gadgets and bits and pieces in, ease the power down, give them a bit more traction. And actually, some of the traction had to be switched off because they were so clever, these vehicles, that they wouldn't do what they were supposed to do. You try and slide a car with traction control on, or just take it off a touch, and the car itself then kind of corrects itself and says, no, I'm supposed to be keeping all of these wheels straight and on the ground. So they had to play about with them and come up with a plan that they could get it done. But the way it's filmed, then of course Jim Dowdle then had to dive in and do some driving for Bond as well, because Ray, sadly, in the middle of one of these chase moments, to come around this turn here, swing the back end out and then disappear out of shot, swung the back end out and disappeared into an iceberg, you know, and wrecked the car. There wasn't a single piece of panelling on the car which wasn't at 90 degree angles in some shape or form. It was absolutely horrible. Fix it, right, take the rest of the day off. And Jim put the wig on, you know, so that was it. They're brutal at some points when you get to you've got to get the shot done before the light goes. Right, you put the wig on. But that's what it is. You know, it's very dangerous driving on ice, which is what they were doing. That much ice, you know, not a lot of ice, but that much ice. And they were concerned about losing the location as well. So to do what they did, I think it's a magnificent thing. You know, it is then ruined by the tidal wave and the surfing and all of that sort of nonsense. But, you know, take the items at face value.
You have to discuss that because it wasn't a stunt.
No, quite right. But the thing is, I tell you what the other thing is for me, and because it's in two parts for me, that Dine of the Day is very special to me as well, because I was invited down onto the set at Aldershot, right? So I'm thinking, this is amazing. I'm on a Bond movie. I can't believe this. You know, it's absolutely appalling weather. It's muddy. It's shocking. I've got waders on. My dad was certainly a fisherman. And I said, I'm going to have to borrow something because chances are it's going to be shocking. So I had these waders on. The mud was up to my knees. I mean, it was really very bad in places. And I said, if this is what North Korea's like, I'm never going to go, frankly. It's bloody awful here. It really is. And watching Vic and the stunt guys film the sequences and watching Terry Madden create the sections and organize everybody was a fascinating part of the day. So to see all of that and to see the hovercrafts moving and to, right, you need to be here, and then the hovercrafts were better controlled by motorcyclists. They had all the guys who were driving those had better control because they're this type of control. You've got more idea of having to swing the back ends out. You've got to think about corners early before you get there. So all of that sort of stuff. Then when I saw it in the cinema, I was so disappointed was the problem because I'd been there and I'd watched this scene being filmed and I couldn't hear it. You know, the noise I thought was extraordinary. The soundtrack had disappeared all over the place. I thought it was very, very complicated. I think it's David Arnold's most complicated score of all. I think he's maybe pushing the boat out far too far on this one with playing cue, you know, recording cues and then playing them backwards. Why? I don't know. It's all a bit mad. So there's all of that going on. And so there are a number of standout moments that I think, oh, this is great. I was there. I watched this happening. And then you go, oh, I don't know. There's just something just eating away at me a bit. But, you know, who'd have thought a hovercraft? So that was the thing at first. When people were going, really? A chase scene and a hovercraft? Why not a hot air balloon chase? You know, those silly things. You go, you can't do that. And yet they kind of made it work, and there's no speeding up of the film. You know, that's the actual speed they're travelling at. They just got it by having cameras on wires going in one direction and the hovercraft going in the opposite direction to create that speed thing, you know. It's certainly one of the things that will stay with me forever. It was a wonderful day being down there, and I'll never forget it. I just wish it wasn't for that movie, maybe. That's my only gripe. But
you weren't one of those waders, were you, in North Korea when you see the cars stuck in the mud?
I don't know where that was filmed, actually. I don't know where that was. I tell you what, when they finished for the day, right, that's it, I have done, thank you, boom, and everybody's gone. And me, and I'm stood there on my jack, not a soul anywhere, and there's cars pulling out all over the place and 4x4s going everywhere. Anyway, this about half an hour later, this Land Rover turns up and said, you all right, mate? I said, does it look like I'm all right? I'm trying to get back to the number one position to go home. Oh, sorry, mate. Sorry. In you come. So I managed to take me back, and then I had to find my shoes. I wasn't allowed to bring my own shoes. I had to leave them there in the office so that I could then transfer them afterwards. It's a very peculiar situation. I tell you what, Aldershot was unbelievable. This demilitarized zone that they'd created, of course, it was on the military base back there. It was extraordinary. They created it over a couple of days, and that's where they did all the explosions and bits and pieces. I think Pierce had done some bits down there, but majority of it was done by the doubles. But yeah, it was a great day. There are some other great things happening. There are good fights in the picture as well.
Set time is 6 minutes. 6 minutes. Check.
The fencing scene, I think, is quite nice, although it's a bit long. But I like they had a guy called Ben Bellman, who was a stuntman, not for very long, to be fair, but he was on the register and was one of the doubles on that, doing the fighting there. And of course, they were trained to do all of that fencing from scratch. So there's a great deal. I don't know how much work Pierce had done in the past with fencing. Apparently, he'd done some fence work before. Yeah, some terrific stuff going on there, I must admit. And that fight itself, of course, bringing we mentioned Rocky earlier, and he's in that as well. You know, he's in it again as one of the guys in the background in the club as the fencing goes on around. Primarily for safety, they bring the stunt guys in so that they can take care of the other extras that are around, you know. But I mean, the movie itself has got a number of exciting high points, and it won awards. You know, the fight that Halle Berry has with Miranda Frost at the end won a Taurus Award the following year. Taurus is the World Stunt Awards. It's independent. It's not. It was organized through Red Bull, financed through Red Bull at the time, the Taurus Foundation, and they won an award for best fight. And of course, Amanda Foster, who doubles Halle Berry, was the first black stunt performer that Britain had ever had, you know, and that was 2002.
Wow. Amazing.
It had nothing up until that point at all. So it's another chink in the armor there. But that's, you know, that you take a lot from it, I must admit, even though it's it's not regarded as I suppose it depends how the younger you are and the more fantastical you like, you know, then it's probably right up there. It's one of those movies that you can put on at the end of a busy day and go, right, I'm going to relax now. I'll watch Die Another Day. You know, I can't do it myself.
Not Steve.
I can't do it. I've only ever seen it twice from beginning to end.
You have to watch it many times.
Yes, to get it. Yeah, I know. But once was the cinema, and then once was when I met my wife, and she agreed foolishly to watch every Bond. She'd never seen one, to watch every Bond film with me, and that was my story for the second time. I think it's pretty poor all the way. I think it's dreadful from the moment Halle Berry comes out of the sea and they do the feet thing, which I have to leave the room. I found it so cringeworthy. And it's up until then, it's been quite average. From that point onwards, I just can't watch it. I just think the film is absolutely embarrassing.
What's always struck me, I mean, you're quite right. It's appallingly written.
Yeah.
It's directed by a lunatic. and they've given him huge sums of money and said, go on and do what you want to do. You know, you go, what? And it just progressive. And this obsession, and we'll touch on this later probably if we ever get there, this obsession with, you know, we must have as many callbacks to as many other movies as we possibly can. Right, go. You go, oh, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
Why?
No, you know,
why does Pierce sniff Rosa Klebb's shoe? What is the point of that? Just little moments where you go, don't do that. Just get on with it. You know, heaven's sake. Oh, dear. I don't know. If anybody, on the other hand, has ever watched a decent Lee Tamahori movie, then please do write in.
Alone Came a Spider is watchable.
To a point, yes.
It's decent.
Morgan Freeman saves it, though, doesn't he?
But The Edge with Anthony Hopkins and Alec Baldwin.
That's the
terrific two-hander, yeah. It's a David Mamet script, isn't it, as well?
Yeah. Maybe he'd had some treatment for his lunacy by that time, do you think?
No, this is probably before.
Was it before?
He hadn't lost it at that stage.
Oh, my goodness. I found it fascinating that he would be given the option to direct it on the basis of one independent New Zealand movie that nobody had ever seen.
Yeah, it is unusual.
Very odd in that respect. And yet Barbara and Michael said, oh, this guy is magnificent. Okay, show us something that he's been in. I just found it fascinating. Yeah.
He also got rid of Danny Boyle, so.
Oh, well, you know.
Really the worst.
That's all for part four of our look into the best stunts of the James Bond franchise. But join us for the fifth and final part, where we look at the Daniel Craig era and the future of the stunts in the world of James Bond.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited-edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.